Priority Quartet has been a familiar sight and sound to Wisconsin classical music audiences for over 70 years. But by the time World War II stranded the Belgian quartet in this country, it had 30 years of performing and recording to its credit. How did it become an international phenomenon in the first place? I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Air.
How successful was the Priority Quartet, or the Quatuor Priority as it was first known, during the early years of recording? What made its members decide to emphasize new music? And how did they make the transition from a Belgian quartet to an American one? Our guest is Tully Potter, longtime contributor to international music journals, former editor of Classical Record Collector, and the author of the two-volume biography, Adolf Busch, The Life of an Honest Musician. He's also working on a book about the great string quartet ensembles.
Welcome to University of the Air and to Madison.
Thank you.
For those of us who grew up in Madison, as I did, we just sort of got used to the Priority Quartet being here, sort of this institution that was always in town, and may not have thought about how long a history it had. Can you say something about, from a national or international perspective, what difference does this group make, and what unique place does it hold in music?
Well, I think to have a local quartet is fantastic, and for Madison itself, it's obviously of great significance, but also for the whole of Wisconsin, I think, because the present quartet travels around the state, and it also broadcasts and so on, and makes recordings, and it's quite a sort of treasure, resource, whatever modern word you want to use, for the people of Madison and the wider Wisconsin. Historically, it's of absolute unique quality because, I mean, there are one or two quartets still going that started after the Second World War, but there's no quartet that's been going for 100 years.
And if we go back to its earliest years, 1911, 1912, they were already beginning to concertize outside of Belgium fairly soon, weren't they?
The beginnings are a little bit scrappy, and obviously there was a First World War, which actually split one of the members from the others, because he fled with a lot of other Belgians to London. London was full of Belgian refugees and quite a lot of important musicians, including Isai. And Mr. Prevost, the violist of the quartet, he went to London first and then enlisted and went back and fought in the trenches and ended up as a sergeant. And I think really their career starts in about 1919, very early in 1919, when they were reunited.
With the quartet changing its membership so many times over its 100-year history, it sort of raises the question, what does it have to do to still be the same quartet?
Well, of course, it isn't the same quartet. But I think you can be modern players in a modern situation and still have ideals and traditions to as benchmarks, really. I think that's what it is. And you look back and think, well, what can we do to keep up those ideals?
So what were they? Let's say that we've got the four musicians at the beginning of this quartet in Belgium. What made it a distinctive group?
I think the leader, Alphonse Onu, I think he was a very intellectual player, a brilliant player, and I think that he had an absolute yearning to play new music, and that is relatively rare. And I think the great thing about the Quatuor Priority, the original bunch, was that they really mixed new music in with the ordinary music, and quite unselfconsciously. And so they took a Hindemith quartet up to Newcastle in England, you know, that kind of thing. Not everybody did that sort of thing. It would be much easier to play Dvorak or something. And I think they attracted the attention of Mrs. Coolidge, the amazing Elizabeth Sprague Coolidge, relatively early on in their real career. And she sent them around Italy first in 1924, playing Piero Lunaire, which only three of them were in.
Cutting edge.
Yeah, and also they started that those concerts with a piece by Casella, Alfredo Casella, the Italian pianist and composer. And so they were from the start identified with new music, but of course also with their own Franco-Belgian music. That's Debussy, Ravel. Ravel they knew, Franck, Fauré. They probably knew Fauré. I don't personally know whether they did. He was getting a bit old by then. And they happened to record the quartets by those four composers.
And if we listen to a little more of the Debussy quartet that we were opening with, what should we be trying to hear in this?
Well, I have a great opinion about the Debussy that there are three faster movements which have to be absolutely kept up to tempo, and they do that. And then I think in the slow movement you can have a lot more leeway, and they take that leeway and they let their tone blossom and all that sort of thing, but they go for the first movement and the other two faster movements, you know, the finale and the second movement, which is a scherzo.
And this is a recording from 1933?
Yep.
Priority Quartet, or it was still then known as the Quatuor Pro Arte, the original Belgian ensemble, recorded in 1933 with the first movement of the Debussy G minor quartet, which then would have been new music.
Yes, it was. I mean, it was written in the 1890s, but it was still very new, and so was the Ravel, which was first written in about 1904. And nowadays, I mean, I can go to a concert and the modern work will still be the Ravel.
Yeah, well, that's right. That's very true. And how common was it for string quartets to record? There's so many recordings that we'll actually be getting through during this conversation from the 30s with the Pro Arte. But how common was it for a string quartet to be that prolific in recording back then?
Well, HMV, His Master's Voice, was a wonderful company. I mean, in economic terms, they shouldn't have made any of these recordings, but of course they did have artistic aims as well. And they had three fantastic, what you might call, house quartets. They had the Busch Quartet, maybe the greatest of all, the Budapest, very well known in America, of course, and the Pro Arte. And between them, those guys got through an enormous amount of music. Unfortunately, the man who was the sort of eminence grise of HMV, Fred Geisberg, very interesting American, funnily enough, he wanted to have society editions, which meant that people could subscribe to all the works of Haydn, and he wanted someone to record all the works of Haydn. And he said to the Pro Arte, oh, do you play all the Haydns? And they said, oh, yes. And, of course, third day of sessions, they turn up and they were among the first artists into the new Abbey Road studios, more famous for the Beatles, but actually, yes. For me, they're famous for the great classical artists. And third day, they come up and there's Haydn Opus 20, number 2, and they don't know it at all. And so they're faced with having to sight read it without telling HMV.
And their tempo for that actually then became, if it's the one I'm thinking of, is one of the Haydn quartets that this sort of surprised them, and they played it, I guess, maybe more slowly because they were sight reading it, and then that became the standard, didn't it?
I think that happened with a lot of them. I think they sight read more than one, actually, because they certainly told that to some friends. And the daughter of those friends has told me that.
Well, and the recording quality was so good, if you think about it, from 1933, and they would not have been able to do the kind of editing that's now done to splice together things.
No editing at all. I don't want to insult American engineers at all, but I think that the London engineers, they were better than the French, better than the Italian, the Germans. They'd got to an absolute peak of perfection with electrical 78 RPM recording. That's to say, since about 1925, they'd been using a microphone. And they had it down to a fine art. It was very primitive in some ways, but they got tremendous fidelity.
And the timing, though, in terms of how much music you could get on a disc or a set of discs, that must have affected the tempo from time to time.
Occasionally. Sometimes they could really they could go up to about 6 minutes if the music wasn't too loud. But on at least one occasion, with the scherzo of the Franck Quartet, they made the Pro Arte do another take. And the ideal tempo for the Franck scherzo is about 5.25, 5.5 minutes. And at least one other previous recording had done a whole disc for it. That's two sides. But they wanted to get it on one side for economic reasons. And they made them come down to 4.75 minutes, which you can just about. So that's a fair. And they take it at a fantastic lick, and it's exciting, but maybe not quite what they would have done in the concert hall.
Not quite what Franck had in mind.
And if you listen to a recording of the Pro Arte playing a Debussy or a Haydn, what makes it a sort of distinctive sound for this particular quartet? If you didn't know it was that quartet and you were trying to distinguish between it and something else, what would you hear?
Well, you hear a very Franco-Belgian sound, and this is easier to recognize than to express in words, but there's a sort of lightness, a sec quality, not exactly dry, but the wine kind of dry sound, but very able to sort of blossom into quite a voluptuous sound, but never overdone, the vibrato never overdone, and a lightness, I think lightness, very light on their feet. They had a fantastic cellist who was actually their third cellist, who had joined them at the end of 1922, Robert Maas. And he, I think, gave them a wonderful bass. And they had two fantastic violinists. The second violin in the early days occasionally led. And they had a wonderful violist with a beautiful instrument. And they all had quite good instruments, and they could make lovely sounds.
Is there a recording we can listen to that you think sort of epitomizes their sound in these early days?
I think that Debussy does. But I also think the Borodin Nocturne, perhaps,
which comes from one of Borodin's string quartets.
That's the beautiful slow movement from the Borodin D major quartet as played by the Belgian Proarti Quartet, a recording from 1933. We'll have more about the history and early sounds of the Proarti Quartet on its 100th anniversary when we continue in a moment with University of the Year.
Thank you.
That's the Pro Arte Quartet, then known as the Quatuor Pro Arte, performing in Abbey Road Studios in 1932. The Adagio from the C Major Quartet, Opus 54, number 2 of Haydn. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Tully Potter, who is an expert on the recordings, the early recordings in particular, of the Pro Arte Quartet. And there's quite a trove of them from the 1930s, the years before the quartet came to America and became established here. Now, did they not complete this Haydn cycle that HMV asked for, which is a lot of string quartets?
Oh, it's a lot. I mean, they got through 29, of which...
a good show.
That's pretty good. Two of them are now thought by some scholars, though not by me, I have to say, to be by some non-entity called Roman Hofstetter.
Oh, right. Yes, of course. Yes.
And for at least one of those, HMV is sort of pushed out the boat and gave them very long sides and got the whole quartet onto two sides.
It's the Hofstetter that has that very famous Andante Cantabile.
That's right, the serenade.
Yeah.
How many more quartets were there of Haydn's that they could have recorded?
Well, it's a slightly moot point, yeah. But they run up to about 80, don't they?
Well,
I think.
Goodness.
Yeah, quite a few opus numbers.
I've never done a complete count because... there are one or two early ones that might be divertimenti or whatever, you know.
Yeah, because Haydn, to a great extent, defined the genre, I mean, during the course of a long career of writing string quartets.
Definitely, and I mean, the older I get, the more Haydn I listen to, and I think it was very important to have this music available, and I think that a whole generation learnt the Haydn quartets from these recordings by the Pro Arte, and they did a lot of the really important ones. There's a wonderful E-flat, which doesn't have a nickname or anything, Opus 64, number 6. People should check that one out sometime. And there's wonderful music in there.
How did they approach Beethoven, then, who was part classical and part romantic?
They did a lot of Beethoven, and they did their first Beethoven cycle for his centenary. They did it in Barcelona in 1927. And they gave Beethoven cycles in Brussels, of course, Cambridge. They did several in Cambridge. They were sort of annual fixtures in Cambridge, while the Busch Quartet were annual fixtures in Oxford. And they did it in Copenhagen and in America. So they took the Beethoven cycle around. I don't think they were quite as penetrative in Beethoven as the Busch Quartet, but they had their own special qualities.
And if we listen to the recording you have of the Allegro from the E minor Beethoven quartet, what should we be listening for?
Well, I think that the sound, first of all, I think there is a Beethoven sound, and it comes more naturally to European quartets, perhaps, than to quartets from other countries. Thank you.
have a recording of them doing the famous Trout Quintet of Schubert, and that would be with Arthur Schnabel as the pianist.
That's right, and I think it's perhaps the most successful of their collaborations. Schnabel had a lot of clout with HMV. They loved him, and Fred Geisberg loved him. And one of their other recordings, which I don't sort of put forward simply because the cello's under-recorded, but it's a wonderful performance, is the Mozart G minor piano quartet. And they actually do both repeats in the first movement, which necessitates an extra disc. And if the listener listens to sides 1 and 3 and sides 2 and 4, you can get the whole first movement. But Schnabel said, no, we've done it in concert just a day or so ago. We're going to do the whole thing. And so HMV had to make everyone pay for an extra disc.
For those repeats.
Well, let's listen to the Schubert. This is the A major piano quintet, and it's a recording from 1933.
From the finale.
Such a rich sound, isn't it, to have the piano and the quartet together like that?
Yes, of course, you have three members of the quartet. You have Alphonse Onu, Laurent Huller, and Robert Maas. And you also have the great English double bassist, Claude Hobday, from a very famous musical family. And in fact, the Pro Arte also worked in the studio with his brother Alfred, who was a leading viola player.
Did this group have any premier works or commissioned works that the way the current Pro Arte Quartet has commissioned so many?
Millions. I couldn't even begin to tell you, but there's about, there's four by Mio and Honegger, loads of composers who are almost forgotten now, but Mrs. Coolidge was always commissioning things for them. commissions take money, of course. Composers need money as much as anybody else.
So you need a patron like Mrs. Coolidge.
Yes, you do.
And of course, they take time, too. It can be a couple of years' delay before you get the product.
And sometimes you don't get it on time.
Don't get it at all or don't get what you like. I guess one of the more famous examples, not a commission that was intended originally for them, was the Samuel Barber string quartet.
Yes, I think.
With the famous Adagio for Strings in it, which I believe was supposed to go to, I want to say the Cleveland Quartet. I'm not sure I'm right about that, but there was a timing issue, and so the Parati got it.
Yes, it's a lovely work, of course. I'm certainly the Adagio is. I'm never quite sure about the outer movement.
Well, they're not quite as lyrical by a long shot, I guess.
We were listening to a piano quintet, the Schubert. Can you say something before we listen to it about the Bloch piano quintet?
Yes. They played Bloch's first string quartet, which is a massive piece and I think a masterpiece. That's another thing that listeners might like to check out. It's the first string quartet is one of Bloch's Jewish works. He had works that he thought of as part of a sort of Jewish project to advance Jewish music in the 20th century. Now, the first piano quintet, which the Pro Arte actually recorded, is a much more international kind of piece. It's Bloch not trying to be specifically Jewish. I mean, he was a Swiss composer, and somehow Swiss composers, they sit sort of at the center of Europe and put tentacles out in all directions and get all sorts of influences. And we'll hear some of the slow movement, which I think it almost makes time stand still. And I suspect that the suggestion for doing it came from the Italian pianist and composer Alfredo Casella, who actually plays with them. And interestingly, I've got a letter that Fred Geisberg wrote to him a week before the sessions, telling him they're prepared to do it, but obviously slightly reluctantly. And they'll all have to share the 10% royalty. So, of course, they each got 2%.
This is the Pro Arte with Alfredo Casella as the pianist in 1933 with the Andante from the first piano quintet of Ernst Bloch. The slow movement of Ernst Bloch's first piano quintet, Pro Arte Quartet, in Abbey Road Studios again.
We're going to look at more music of the early Pro Arte Quartet when we continue in a moment with the University of the Air. Priority hearts are heavy, Belgians in quartet anxious for families. Music may flow from their fingers, but the hearts of the three Belgian members of the Priority String Quartet were heavy today with worry over their families in Europe. That's from the Wisconsin State Journal in 1940 as the visiting Priority Quartet from Belgium got stranded during the war. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is music historian Tully Potter, and we're talking about the early Priority Quartet and some of the historical recordings that are available to sample the sound of this amazing group that is now celebrating its 100th anniversary. It's not only possibly one of the oldest quartets having a continuous history, but also the first to have an artist in residency at a university as well. Tell us about some of the composers that this quartet got to know, got to work with personally.
Well, all the composers that we call Les Six, you know, from Paris, that means Poulenc and Auric, Mio, Honegger, all of those. I got to know Ravel, Stravinsky. Stravinsky admired them. He writes in his autobiography how wonderfully they played a program of his works. And they knew almost everybody who was on the scene in those days.
It seems like such a treasure to get to work with Ravel or Stravinsky, or you get to have conversations with some of the people that we now consider such classics.
Well, I think that composers are always happy to have living laboratories, you know, mm-hmm. and a quartet can be like that. And it's easier to work with a quartet of really first-rate instrumentalists, perhaps, than working with a whole orchestra. And I think that a lot of composers have, it's a whole separate subject, really, mm-hmm. but one thinks of Shostakovich with the Beethoven Quartet, who premiered nearly all his works.
And Pro Arte was, at this point, by the time we're getting into the mid-30s, they're crisscrossing the Atlantic all the time, aren't they?
They made 29 crossings altogether, the odd number being that, of course, the last time they didn't go back again.
Yes, it was 28 and a half, maybe, then. Right, round trips. And as long as we've mentioned Ravel, we haven't heard any of their performing of Ravel yet, but Ravel does have one landmark string quartet.
Yes. I don't know why so many French composers wrote only one string quartet, but of course Mio made up for it by writing a whole load. Yes. The Pro Arte played Ravel's quartet as early as 1923. They conquered Paris with some concerts for the La Revue Musicale. Sort of avant-garde musical magazine.
A lot of avant-garde music in Paris in the 20s.
Absolutely. And I should mention that there were some very, very good French quartets in the 20s and 30s, at least three or four of tremendous quality and who made records and so on. And they, you know, they were in that company. They stood very tall. And they also stood tall because they played so much of the modern music. With Ravel, in 1926, they actually took part in an all-Ravel program, and they played not only the quartet, but they played the septet, or introduction and allegro, with wonderful players. Marcel Moyes, the famous flautist, Lily Leskin, who went
famous
on playing
harpist.
The harp for decades.
Yes.
I think she was just out of college at that point, or conservatory. And the clarinetist, Hamelin. And so they were right up there, you know, they were on the cutting edge all the time.
Let's listen to the slow movement from the F major quartet by Ravel.
It's marked very slowly.
Yes.
And do you think it's slow enough?
I do. I always see the Basque country. Ravel was very proud of his mother coming from the Basque country. And I find that movement very brightly lit. And I think the colours they get, this is another quality of theirs. I wrote an article about them just the other day, and I said you'd need to find four modern quartets to cover all the bases that the old Quattuor Pro Arte covered.
It must have taken courage on the part of the Pro Arte Quartet to perform new music, to sort of, you know, not just stick with the safe and the chestnuts.
Well, of course, they were young when they started. One always forgets this. One doesn't always see. I do have one photograph of them from 1922 where they look a bit younger. But one tends to see Pablo Casals, for instance. You know, one thinks of him as being an old man.
Yes.
Of course, he was an extremely hot-blooded young man at one point.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's much easier to do that when you're young and you can have a go. Nobody's going to hold it against you.
What did the Pro Arte Quartet do with Bartok, who did write a fair amount of string quartets?
Well, they unfortunately only recorded the first, but they played the second, the third, and they actually asked him for the dedication of number four. They didn't get the premiere because he had his own friends who toured abroad as the Hungarian Quartet, and they were led by a great violinist called Imre Waldbauer, and unfortunately never made any records. But that particular quartet gave premieres of Bartok and Kodály as far back as 1910. And so they didn't. The Pro Arte didn't get the premiere, but they did get the dedication of number four, but sadly didn't record it.
Well, let's listen to some of the first quartet by Bartok. This is a recording from 1934.
Some big sound that comes out of their playing of the Bartok.
Yes, fantastic cello playing again. I mean, they were all terrific, but I think the bass line is so important, and the cello is such a great instrument, and Robert Maas was really extraordinary. And I like to think that recording came as a result of a sort of after-hours demonstration they did. They were packing their instruments away after a session, and they discovered that none of the HMV technicians present knew any Bartok chamber music. So they took the instruments out again and played the whole of the first quartet. And so maybe Mr. Geisberg was there, or the others told him about it, and they said, we must record this.
Any amusing anecdotes about the personalities of these four musicians, the early ones?
Well, I mean, I've got some candid photos of them mucking about in the garden, and I think Maas had a tremendous sense of humour. There's a photo of him holding his cello under his chin, and another one of him dancing with it as a guitar. Oh, I think they had a lot of fun. I think that quartets have to share a sense of humour, and you find in any quartet there's always one who's a slight jester and sort of easer of tensions. I think it was probably Germain Prévost, who was the viola, who filled that role in the Pro Arte. But they all had genial temperaments.
Well, we haven't heard any Mozart from the Pro Arte Quartet yet, so let's drop back a few years for some of that. What would it be?
Well, this is the great Adagio, the Mozart G minor quintet, which is a wonderful work. And incidentally, this was the first recording I ever knew of it. And they're here with the other Hobday, Alfred Hobday, playing the viola. And we'll hear the second of the slow movements. It's an Adagio leading into the famous delightful finale, which some people think is too frolicsome and light for such a great work, but I think just shows that other side of Mozart, that he was quite happy to write some of the most solemn and profound music and follow it up with something absolutely delightful.
Tully Potter, it's been a delight having you with us this hour.
Well, it's wonderful to come to Madison and see all the wonderful lakes and the beautiful city and just be among some very nice people.
Well, thanks for telling us about the Pro Arte Quartet Between the Wars.
I'm Emily Auerbach with Norman Gilliland, hoping you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Year.